Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to I'd Sooner Forget This, a podcast where guests share with you a part of themselves from their past. For example, when I was 21, I wrote a blog titled Class, which ended with this paragraph. Love them or hate them, class divides are always going to be there. The superclass is evidence that money is not enough to allow you access to the elite. But do you really want to be part of the elite? They're so inbred that they all look like horses. I would rather go down a mine. And at least I would have my dignity. I'm Daryl Smith, and joining me this week is comedian George Rigdon.
Hello, mate.
You all right?
Yeah, good, man. Lovely flat you've got, by the way.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's very nice. Yeah.
What's your favourite thing in there?
I like the Epiphone SG. That's pretty good as a guitar for the laymans at home. It's beautiful. How long have you had that?
13 years.
So you got it when you were 14?
Yeah.
Are you from money? How did you afford that?
I don't know. I can't remember.
It's like 400 quid, isn't it?
No, that was like 300 quid.
That's £100 less. It's not much less. It was like 300 quid. It was a bargain.
I don't know. This isn't what this podcast is about, George.
Sorry, mate. It's a lovely guitar. And I'm very happy for you.
Thank you very much. Right.
Good God.
George, what have you got for us?
I've sort of got two things. I've got two things to talk about. I've got one thing with me because the other thing I gave to someone else, and we'll get to that later. But right now I've got with me a CD that I bought when I was 15, when I was on holiday in France, and I had a really unhealthy obsession, and still do to this day, with the band The Pogues. And the very best of The Pogues was on sale on CD in this French hypermarché, as my dad calls it, because he doesn't speak French. And I became such a big fan of The Pogues that I started kind of stalking them a bit. And I went to go see them. I actually became quite friendly with one of them.
And you became friendly with one of The Pogues?
Yeah. I still sort of am. Not as much as I was, because he lives in America now, and I probably took it too far.
Which member of The Pogues?
His name's Spider Stacy. He played the tin whistle. Yeah, genuinely
true.
What's
a tin whistle?
It's the penny whistle. You know penny whistle?
Like an Irish whistle. Yeah.
Yeah, he played that. And he was really sound and really cool and still is. I wrote to him because I became pathetically obsessed with them. And I wrote to him saying I was his number one fan, which makes me want to kill myself. and he replied saying, no one has ever said that before. it was at the time I was like, oh, great. But now I'm mortified of embarrassment that I ever said that to a grown man. But yeah, he was really, really lovely. And he used to give me free tickets to go see them and stuff. And I used to go with my friends every year. And it was always great fun. And the first time I went, I took the CD along and, just in the hope of getting signed by a few of the band. It was like after party kind of thing that I was invited to. And I was just walking around with a Sharpie, just getting a more descriptive on it. But Shane McGowan, the lead singer of The Pogues, and probably my actual hero, wasn't there because he was obviously fucking hammered. and they wouldn't let me meet him because I was like 15, and it probably would have trod some legality problems.
Yeah.
But I remember really vividly, so Spider's girlfriend Louise, who's really nice, ran off with my CDM autograph book, because I was an autograph collector back then, and we'll get to more of that later. And she ran off with those things to get them signed by Shane, and she came back and he signed the CD on the inside of the of the inlay, he signed it saying, "Dear George, up the IRA." And I mean, it feels a little. That's comparable to, I think, carrying a shoe bomb with your hand like a child. Yeah. Like, you took that onto a plane. They'd be like, "What is this? Why is that? Why have you got that?" Oh, I'm just a big fan of the Pogues. Yeah, but why the IRA thing? I couldn't tell you. But yeah, he did that. And my mate who I was with as well, because we were both, his name was Andy, we were both autograph hunters. And he took his autograph book as well. And because I think Louise, in the walk from us to Shane, it was like backstage, about like 200 feet away, we couldn't see him or anything. She'd forgotten my mate's name because I just brought him along. And because she'd forgotten his name, he just wrote "to fucking nobody." Just, it was like such an insane man. But he wrote the greatest song of all time. So there you go.
Which is?
Fairy Tale of New York is the best song of all time. Daryl, come on.
Well, I didn't want to immediately
assume that I'd be that basic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to go for like an album track.
Can you name any album tracks?
No.
No, the Pogues are great. That's the thing. Like, they are genuinely amazing. But yeah, Fairy Tale of New York, I think it's the best song ever written.
I'm really amazed by how you got heavily involved with the Pogues.
Right, okay.
Like, how does a 15-year-old, like, end up at a Pogues party?
So, I remember really vividly, like, my mum used to, I used to be in a brass band. Can you believe I lost my virginity in my early to mid-20s? I was in a brass band with my mum until I was about 18. From the age of about... I think she started taking me on when I was about 8. I was really young when I started playing. And we were both in this thing called a training band, which practiced on a Friday night. It was like younger, like... It was like teenagers and stuff, like playing brass instruments and stuff. And she would drive me along. And every Christmas, like... Because my dad's a miserable bastard, we wouldn't have Christmas lights on our house. But me and my mum both loved, like, really tacky sort of houses adorned with Christmas lights and stuff. So she would like drive us, we'd leave for band practice about an hour early and just go around all the sort of houses on the way to the band practice, looking at all the houses with big Christmas lights on, just sort of go like, "Oh, look how wonderful that is." And when we did that, we'd have like a Christmas CD on in the car. And I remember like, so it was like the first six tracks were John Lennon, the War Is Over one, Wonderful Christmas by Paul McCartney. I think it was Wizard and then Slade and then Band-Aid. Those are the first five, and I already knew all those songs, and I don't know why, but I'd obviously, but then number six was Fairy Tale of New York, and I'd obviously heard it before, like just by proxy, but like I'd never like listened to it, which sounds really lame, but I just heard it in the background, but I never like sort of sat and listened to it as a song. And I was about 14 at the time, and I remember saying to my mum, this song is fucking amazing, who is it by? I didn't swear, I wouldn't dare swear in front of my mum, because she would have kicked me out of the car. But I said, this song's amazing. Who's it by? And she said, "It's by the Pogues and Kirsten McColl. It's great." I said, "Yeah, it is amazing. This is brilliant." And just over that Christmas and actually beyond, I became like insanely obsessed with that song, to the point that I was listening to it like every day, like 30, 40 times. And like my parents recorded this thing on BBC One that was on Christmas Eve, where it was like the best Christmas songs of the 80s thing. And that was like, they covered the Pogues and about it. And it was like really interesting. And they interviewed like some of the Pogues, like Spider and Shane McGowan, they interviewed on there. And I remember thinking, like, these guys are so fucking cool. And then we just got cable, so the video for the song was on all the time. Like I used to tape it every time it was on. Like I was going to lose the tape. Like I don't know what.
So you had multiple recordings of the same song?
Your tone insinuates that that's a weird thing to do, but I would suggest that you're weird for not doing that. On VHS, I had about like maybe like 20 recordings of the Fairy Tale of New York music video. So the thing to realize about the Pogues is that, like, if you only know that song, is that they were actually like a really credible punk band. Like they were like the punk folk, they were quite innovative. Shane McGowan had been in like punk bands, Spider had been in punk bands as well. They were punk musicians who just happened to pick up Irish instrumentation to give it a go. And and they sort of created this weird formula, like really frenetic sort of punk rock but done with like folk instrumentation, which have done loads now, like Dropkick Murphys and Flogging Molly and bands like that. But they were the first ones to do it. So they all looked really fucking cool. Like they weren't just like weird like Irish people with like tweed on and stuff. They all dressed like punks. And Spider, in the video, I remember like they all wearing like black suits, and Spider was sat like on like, just like a lounge chair, just playing the tin whistle. And he had like slick back hair. He was in, like a black suit with a buttoned up shirt. And I remember thinking that guy is so fucking cool playing that really lame instrument. Like everything like that is so fucking rock and roll that like a guy can look as badass as that with like an earring in and stuff and still look amazing despite playing what was effectively a recorder, like it was a kid's instrument. And I remember like because I used to collect autographs because I was you know, a little bit. I don't want to. I'm loath to use the term legendary, but I was a legendary character at my school, by which I mean victim of bullying. I wrote to him because he had a website, and I emailed him saying, like, I'm a huge fan. I said number one fan, which is so fucking lame. And I think he was really flattered by that because obviously he probably never got any fan mail at all because the Pogues hadn't really been around for a long time, and no one's really a fan of it. It's like saying that Ringo Starr's your favourite Beatle. Like, no one goes after the Tin Whistle player.
Also, it's very interesting that you liked him so much, not because you loved the Tin Whistle, but no, because you loved him.
I don't know what it was. Like, I just, I don't know. He was like, there's just something about him. Like, I mean, I did love the Tin Whistle. And I took it up because of that song, because I loved the fact that like this song, rather than having like a guitar solo, like most songs had a Tin Whistle solo, and it was great. Like, it was so cool. And I told him I was learning it and stuff, and he posted me one of his own and like a signed photo and stuff. And in hindsight, that's the lamest thing in the world. But at the time, I was like, fucking, I was like, this is incredible. And we just chatted loads, and like, I started getting really into music and like really into bands and stuff. And I started my own band at sixth form. And then like a year after me and him started chatting, the Pogues reformed, like, for a load of tours. They'd been broken up for like 15 years or something. But they reformed, because it was weird, like Fairy Tale of New York, like, it was obviously always a big song, but it had like a weird sort of renaissance, I think, when Kirsty MacColl died, and it became big again, like really big, bigger than it's ever been before. And now it's like just regarded as the best Christmas song of all time, whereas at the time it was just kind of a song that people knew. So he told me that they were reforming and said, like, if you want to come along, I can get you like passes and stuff. I said, that sounds fucking amazing. So I took tickets. He gave us tickets to go see them at Birmingham Academy in 2004. And it was me, my dad, and my best friend at the time, Andy, who I also collected autographs with. And we went up, and I'd never been to a gig before. I'd never been to see a live band before. I didn't know what to expect. And I didn't know, like, I mean, I knew the songs because I bought the CD at that point and listened to all the songs and stuff, but I didn't know how raucous they would be live and how raucous their fans would be, because I'd had a very sheltered upbringing. Like, my mum wouldn't let me out at the end of my road growing up until I was about 18. So lame. I remember once I went to a birthday party when I was about 7. That was at our next door neighbour's house, and she walked us to our next door neighbour's house in case we got lost. It's a small road. So I went to see the Pogues with it, and like, because he got passes and stuff. And like, I remember, like, as soon as they started playing, there was this mad rush from the bar. Like, and me and my mate were like, "Oh god!" Because we were just like two fucking weird nerds who just like went around hanging out stage doors and stuff at this fucking punk gig, and I like, just literally got knocked out. And my dad was loving it. He was wearing his beige fleece, and he was moshing. He's like 60 this year, and he was losing his mind. He'd never been happier. But we were sort of like just standing on the fringes, just trying to sort of enjoy the music and stuff. And it was insane. It was a real baptism of fire, because it was the first gig I'd ever been to up to that point. The only band I'd seen up to that point was Steps.
That's a huge gear change.
Yeah, it really is. Because there was a lot. I mean, I think within the first 30 seconds, I don't want to say deliberately, but someone tipped a pint on me. I'd like to think it was accidental, but I probably gave off a vibe of someone who needed a pint tipped.
We need to baptise this boy and let him know what Pose gig is like.
But yeah, it was fucking great. And I went to go see them every year for about 5 years. And it was always amazing. But I've still never met Shane McGowan. Even though I do comedy now, and comedy is my favourite thing in the world, my all-time hero of any kind is him. And I'm a bit sad that I've never met him, and I'm also sad that I probably never will. But at the same time, you know, he's a very damaged guy, so it'd probably be quite heavy.
So, do you still speak to Spider?
In dispatches. Like, he lives in the States now. He used to live in London, but he lives in New Orleans. And we chat a bit. Like, he's on Twitter and stuff. We follow each other, and we chat on there occasionally. But it's, I mean, again, like, I was a fucking kid when I met him. And, you know, now, like, I'm just doing something else. Well, because before, like, he used to be really sort of supportive of my band and stuff. Like, we would like always send him our demos, and he'd like give us a really cool quote that we could use to help it get passed around and stuff. And he used to come see us play live. He was really, really cool and really supportive of us doing music. So I think, I mean, like, since I started doing comedy, I just don't really chat to him as much, because it's not really, like, I can't be like, "Oh, come to my comedy gig," because he's not gonna.
So with the autograph hunting,
yeah,
how did that start?
How did that start? Okay. Oh God. So I, as a kid. I think I say kid. Probably I was probably old enough to know better. when I was about maybe 12 or 13, I became really obsessed with Doctor Who. And this is before they brought Doctor Who back. This is because I'm 28. So this is like 2001. So that is like like 6 years before they brought Doctor Who back to TV. And I was like properly obsessed with like the old Doctor Who's. And I don't really know how that happened.
Yeah. That's interesting that you were into Doctor Who when it was not cool to be into Doctor Who.
Yeah.
I'd argue that it's now not cool to be into Doctor Who again.
I think, yeah, it's come full circle, isn't it? Yeah. So I should get back into it, is what you say.
Yeah.
Just get some hipster points. Yeah. So I was really obsessed with it. And my dad, like, because he remembered it from being a kid and stuff, it was one of the few interests that I had that he actually enabled because he didn't like football. So he bought us tickets to go to this Doctor Who convention, just as a surprise for me. Like, I didn't ask him to, he just did it, and it was really nice. And it was like a whole weekend. And this all sounds like I'm being really sincere, but I'm conscious of how much of a fucking dweeb I was and how lame it all was. And they were like fucking grown men there in costumes. It was all like the old Doctor Who's and all their companions and stuff, like just doing signings all day and doing like Q&As and stuff. And I've always been like really obsessive, and like not in like an endearing kind of sweet way, in a kind of like that is deeply unsettling sort of way. Like I was talking to you before we started the podcast, I have so far this year I've watched Schindler's List 4 times, and it's March. That's 12 hours.
Yes.
That's longer than a working day that I've watched Schindler's List through, like, over and over again. I've always been like that, and I was really obsessed with Colin Baker, who a lot of people confuse with Tom Baker, who's the most iconic Doctor Who, the fourth one. Colin Baker was
the
sixth
one. Was that the one with the scarf?
That was Tom Baker, yeah.
Yeah.
So Colin Baker was the sixth Doctor, like a sort of really sort of like gauche kind of like long jacket with like loads of patchwork sort of colours on it and stuff.
He's not the one who dressed like a cricketer, is he?
That's Peter Davison. He was the one before Colin Baker. He was also at the convention. But yeah, Peter Davison, but Colin Baker was like my favourite. He'd only been doing it for like, he had the shortest tenure of any Doctor. But yeah, he was my favourite. And I went along and like took loads of shit from design. I was like properly like hanging around him like a horrible bad smell. And I think he just indulged me because I was like a kid, and he was kind of like, oh, he's quite sweet and not like a sinister man. But I remember getting all these autographs and stuff, and like it just got this weird sort of bug for getting everything signed, and it just sort of carried on after that and bled into like writing to people and going to stage doors and stuff. And it was, so far, because I haven't sold any of them, a complete waste of 7 years of my life.
So when you were getting stuff signed,
yeah,
is this a signature book or is this specific like items associated?
It varied, to be honest. Like, it depended on who I was going to meet. Like, the most starstruck I've ever been was when I met Neil Finn from Crowded House, and I nearly had a panic attack.
Wow.
It was Neil Finn from Crowded House. Who gives a fuck? Like, it's so pathetic. Like, I've met some really cool... Since I started doing stand-up, I've gigged with some of my favourite childhood heroes and been fine. But I literally had the shakes when I met Neil Finn from Crowded House, to the point that, like, when I handed him like my CD to sign, I dropped it into a puddle. It was so lame. But yeah, like if it was someone I was a particularly big fan, I'd take like a CD along or something, or whatever, like merch, something like that. I wouldn't ever buy anything especially, but I would also get like book signers and shit, and you had to buy the book. You couldn't just not buy the book and just go like, I've come here for some free autographs. And it's like, queue up and just chuck some fucking like paper at like Norman Hunter, the former England centre back or something.
So you'd buy books that you may not necessarily ever read, just so that you could get some stuff signed.
Yeah, well, I did for the first like year, and then I got wise and just thought, I'll just pick up a book in Waterstones that is the book, get it signed, and just dump it somewhere. I'm buying it. That's bad, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, God. So someone somewhere has had a book dedicated to George, just like signed by fucking, like by Phil Power Taylor, the former darts champion, just on like a stand somewhere in Waterstones. Yeah, that's bad, isn't it?
Where's all this stuff now?
It's all at my dad's house in like several crates. And I think if you went through it, because I think a lot of the people I wrote to back then have since died. A lot of people I actually like met and stuff. Like, so I've got like autographs from people who are probably worth quite a bit of money. And I was going to sell some to fund my Edinburgh. But at the same time, I've got like a really weird sort of pathetic emotional attachment to them. And I'm not really sure why. And some of them are rubbish and probably worthless. But yeah, they're still there. Like loads of signed photos, loads of signed books and DVDs and videos and stuff like that. Yeah.
I suppose the thing is that like the ones that no one will care about, it's not worth selling them. And the big ones, they're probably the ones that you care about more.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
So it would make you more money, but it would maybe affect you more emotionally if you were to sell them.
There's a few little anomalies. Like I had Thatcher, and I sold that for 100 quid and didn't have a problem with that. In fact, I felt a little bit like I was sticking it to the man. And that was a proud moment. But there's not many of those. Like, I've got ones that are probably worth more than that I wouldn't be as willing to part with, which is really weird because I need money. I'm so broke all the time.
So what are some of your favourite ones?
My favourite ones. So the Shane McGowan one I love because it's mental. I mean, he's very outspoken in the press about his support for the Irish Republican Army. And, you know, he's allowed to be, you know, it's a free country and stuff. And, you know, they had their reasons for what they did, but they were still bombing stuff. So it's like, it's uncomfortable. But also, yeah, I got Elton John, which was quite nice, and Dustin Hoffman. That's a good one. I've got a framed one of John Hurt somewhere because John Hurt was like always my favorite actor and stuff. Ringo Starr got a signed Thomas video.
Wow. Ringo Starr.
Yeah, that's pretty good, isn't it?
That's an amazing thing to get signed by Ringo
Starr. Yeah, it's good. I'm not sure. I don't know why he did it. I literally just got like, no, I'm not signing that. That's shit. Like, send me rubber salt. Don't send me this. But yeah, he signed it, and that was really, that's worth quite a lot, I think. But again, I don't want to sell it, because it's like a video I had since I was a kid. I just sent him like the sleeve, and it like took like 2 years, and he replied, with like he just came back signed. I was like, oh my fucking God, Ringo Starr replied.
And he won't sign stuff now.
Yeah, have you seen that video?
It's
so funny. It's so, I mean, like, I love the Beatles, I love McCartney, and I love Ringo Starr, but they have gone, I mean, they're obviously mad. Because, like, have you seen the one with Paul McCartney with Meat Free Mondays?
Oh, it's great.
So fucking funny.
I love him.
You can do it right now, please. Yeah, what's he doing?
It's like, we only one take. All we need to do is one take. Absolutely fine.
Meatfreemondays.com. Meatfreemondays.com. Oh, God, he's mental. But never got McCartney. Never got McCartney, which is sad because, you know, but I'd love to see McCartney live, though. That'd be good, wouldn't it?
Would it still now? Is he still any good?
He wasn't very good at the Olympics, was he? But that was about 5 years ago. So maybe he's got better, but he is older, so he's probably got worse.
Yeah, I mean, I think at that point, practice, he's done a lot of it.
He's phoning it in. He's phoning. He doesn't care. Just put him on. Just FaceTime in next time, McCartney. You don't need to be there. But yeah, so Ringo's a good one. But yeah, he starts signing stuff now. That is sad. I love that video, though. It's so funny.
It's glorious.
thank you. But please don't send me anything. Please.
What I like about both of those videos is that clearly no one in the entourage of either of the Beatles knows how to make videos.
It's so funny. They haven't even consulted. Because they're in the Beatles, they don't think they have to consult anyone on anything. They're like, fuck it, I know what I'm doing. Just put a camera on. But like, at no point, like, he just keeps saying peace and love. Why? It's so aggressive. Like, never has peace and love felt so aggressive. peace and love, but I've got too much to do. He keeps saying he's got too much to do. What's he doing? What is he doing?
Is he working his way through the backlog?
He must be done by now.
I feel that's what he said. He said.
Well, how is he, like 75 now?
Yeah.
I mean, fair enough. If he wants to sort of like slow down a bit, that's fine.
Would you want to spend your, like, George, when you eventually become megastar?
Yeah.
Like, when would you want to stop signing stuff?
I think, despite all the people I wrote to and all the people that were really nice to you when I used to collect autographs, I like the idea of being like Jack Nicholson and just throwing stuff in the bin, just not doing it, just be like, can't be fucked, not doing it. And just like, when I do it occasionally, it's only ever for like a really good cause, so it's like worth loads of money. But no, I don't know, I guess probably like, I mean, with the amount I eat, I'm probably going to lose a hand to diabetes anyway. So I'll probably say 50. Just because by then I'll definitely, even if I haven't lost a hand to diabetes, I'll be bored of it. And I'll probably just start writing race hate on things. Not the words race hate, I'll be specific to the person who's written to me.
Or you could write up the IRA as a...
Up the IRA, carry on the legacy that Shane McGowan started in the early to mid-noughties.
Yeah.
Bless him.
What I have noticed with that CD is that you say that you love it a lot.
Yeah.
But it is...
It's knackered, isn't it?
It's knackered, yeah. It's damaged.
Yeah. So here we got the autographs there. So... I put water on it as well.
Yeah. I mean, this doesn't sound like something that you've looked after properly.
No. I haven't looked after many autographs. They're all like folded in half and just all over the place. But the autographs there... So
yeah, but that's what I don't quite understand. Is
what
that
do you mean?
Well, that you're getting the autographs,
yes,
all right, but then you're not preserving them correctly.
Preserving them in a box, under my dad's bed. So that's similar, isn't it?
I think that you enjoyed getting the signatures more than having the signatures.
They were a burden. Yeah, it was a little bit like, you know, like how like some people get like postpartum depression when they have a kid.
Right.
It's like post-autograph depression. Like when you got, you're like, I don't love this. I don't care that, you know, Tony Robinson, Summer Blackadder 4 goes fourth DVD. I don't care. The build-up, it's like Christmas. The anticipation is everything. Yeah. When you get it, you're like, oh, I couldn't give a shit. Couldn't give a shit.
They call it autograph hunting. It must be like the same kind of excitement as hunting.
Yeah, well, I used to do it on a horse with bloodhounds. Yeah. just hounding down people at stage doors, presenting them with a Sharpie and a really sort of dog-eared photo. Like,
is
photograph.
That Handy Andy?
Handy Andy! Is that Craig from Big Brother 1?
It's like a quiz. Is that Brian Bellows?
Is that Brian Connolly? Brian, can you? It's a puppet. Can you write that on the thing? Is that all right? Yeah, God, I was so creepy. Yeah. Some would say I still am, but now it's a stand-up persona in quotation marks, so I get away with it. But as a teenager, it was just who I was. Just a weird guy just wandering around.
With your trip to the Doctor Who convention,
yeah.
But
can we keep all that in? By the way, that was all great.
Oh yeah, that was fantastic.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't we?
I think because there's a worry that if we smash it too hard, it's going to be really hard for Phil Wang and Reardon Jackson to compare to this podcast.
That's absolutely true.
Yeah, I mean, think you should put it in. I think yeah.
I mean, I will. Say, that's definitely saying it. This bit where we're talking about if we're going to keep it in, we'll
keep
not
it
say.
In.
No, let's keep it in. Keep it all in. We're raw. This is like.
This is like, we're like Badil and Skinner unplanned, aren't we, in a way? Got theirs as well. That's pathetic. I sat next to Badil at the Chortle Awards and I couldn't look him in the eye.
What, because you had his signature?
No, because he sang Three Lions and that's like the soundtrack to my youth.
And all you could think about was that fact.
Yeah.
And you wanted to say
it. It was too much, yeah.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
So earlier, when I was driving you here, you alluded to the fact that you did something at this Blue Box convention, which I can see you're holding your arm in a slightly stressed way.
Oh, God.
I think you need to share what you shared with a previous doctor.
Oh, God. See, when we were talking about it before, I was all Billy Big Bollocks. Like, this is such a funny story. But now that I'm aware that it's being recorded and published online, and at least my parents will listen to this. They always listen to podcasts that I do. Oh, God. Okay, fine. So embarrassing. So, as I said, I was obsessed with Doctor Who before it came back. I'm particularly obsessed with Colin Baker, the Sixth Doctor, who, in my opinion, is still the greatest Doctor. I think he's the best actor to ever play Doctor Who, in my opinion. I don't know if you've ever seen any of his stuff.
What are some of his famous episodes?
I wouldn't say any like famous ones. The whole last series he did was like a 14-episode compendium called Trial of the Time Lord, where it's like him on trial on Gallifrey.
The whole series is a trial.
Yeah, it was really weird.
Like Law and Order.
They were trying to be conceptual and it just didn't work, and that's why they pulled him. And normally most Doctor Who stories are like 2 or 3 episodes long and they sort of move on to whatever. But yeah, he had a load of really good ones. But yeah, I really liked him. I thought he was really, like, really good. So I wanted to meet him. So my dad got us tickets to this Doctor Who convention that he was at. And much in the same way I am with women, I was very full on with him. But unlike women, he wasn't put off by that. So he was really sweet and really indulged me. Like across, it was like a 3-day thing, like a whole weekend. And the whole time he was like the nicest man. Like he was so lovely and like made a special effort to chat to me and stuff between stuff. He got me up on stage for a Q&A with him. Yeah, he was just fucking great and really nice. And oh god. I went to a technology college and we did design technology, which is like practical making shit. And for like an art project, I made with my own little hands a really sinister, very detailed clay sort of death mask of Colin Baker's face, complete with like it was his head. And like, I don't know if you know this, but like he wore a really sort of garish like sort of blazer, like with like quite a long sort of frock coat thing with patchwork material, like loads of really horrible clashing colors, but I loved it. And he also wore like sort of blue polka dot sort of like neckerchief thing, almost like Dex's Midnight Runners. So I just did the head with just the neckerchief made out of clay as well. It was so creepy. And I made it knowing I was going to that convention with the intention of giving it to him, which at the time felt like it could only be a good idea. And like it wasn't remotely sinister or similar to just taking a mold of his cock and bollocks and giving it to him. It wasn't like that. It was just a nice boy giving someone, I mean, like, who wants that? I mean, what's the lack of understanding and the lack of like empathy that assuming that someone would, like, if you made that for me, Daryl, I'd be very flattered, you know, because I know that you look up to me as a comedian.
Yeah.
But equally, it would make me never want to see you again. I would never want to see you again.
It's quite intense being given your, I mean, what do you do with a clay model of your own head?
Yeah, it was quite big as well.
How big?
I'd say it was about 8 inches tall. So about the size of a human head. Same size as a human head. Oh god. So like across the whole weekend, he'd been so lovely to me, to the point that it almost felt like he and me were friends, or I sort of kidded myself into thinking that he and me were friends. And so on the last day, because he was like such a nice bloke, he kind of like did the most Q&As and stuff and like met the most fans and sort of like went around and chatted to everyone. And he was doing like the sort of closing of the convention Q&A, like at the end of the last day. Like it was literally the last thing that was going to happen the whole weekend. And and he was up on stage and he was being interviewed by the guy who was like interviewing everyone, the guy who organized the convention basically was like interviewing all the guests. And uninvited, uninvited. There was no, it was like an out-of-body experience. I just got up in the middle of him talking to this guy. There were like 200 like nerdy Doctor Who fans just sat down watching like and listening to Colin Baker chat, and they wanted to hear Colin Baker chat. And unprompted, without any like break in the conversation, I got out of my seat and walked towards the stage where he was sat on the stage, like there was like two chairs facing each other, and just sort of went up like holding it like a holy grail, like almost like I was like gonna like give him holy communion, but with his face. I was sort of carrying it up to the stage and said, "I made this for you at school." And that's what I said. I didn't even say, "Excuse me, Colin, do you mind if I just interrupt a second? I just want to say, so guys, I had a really nice time this weekend." Nothing like that. No like showmanship, just, "I made you this for you. I made this for you. It's your face." Like a serial killer would, like a serial killer would do. And he was so gracious and like lovely about it. And at the time I was like, this is the best moment of my entire life. But in hindsight, it makes me want to die. It makes me want to kill myself. But I got up on the stage and I presented him with the death mask, which is what it was. and he said, "Oh, obviously I hadn't, God. Obviously, I hadn't said, I made this for you, for everyone else to hear. I hadn't said it loud enough. So he had to sort of, go, oh, thank you. Because obviously, like, you can't just take it and go, like, back to your seat then. Like, you can't just carry on with that. You know, he had to be like, he had to break out of it and sort of stand with his arm around me and go, look what George made for me at school. And everyone cheered.
Oh.
Which is worse than, like, booing, because it enabled me. It justified the decision to make it.
Oh, so in that moment, you thought that everything you had done was the right thing.
Yeah. At the time, I thought, this is the best thing I've ever done. There's no way I'm ever going to look back on this and feel a horrible, horrible, overwhelming cloak of shame. And they applauded. They fucking applauded. They applauded. I don't get applause for my comedy. I got applause for a deeply sinister, ashen-faced death mask I'd made of Colin Baker, the sixth Doctor Who. And oh, this is bad. I tweeted him, since I've been doing comedy, I've got ideas above my station, I think I'm actually a really big deal. And I tweeted him saying, like, hey, so do you remember when I made you a death mask? That was pretty weird, wasn't it? And I said, I bet you threw it away. And he said, no, I've still got it. He still has it. Why does he still have it? Burn, incinerate it. That's, what does voodoo?
It must mean something to him then.
What, evidence? I mean, that's all it could possibly be.
Well, by the sounds of it, like, he became quite friendly with you over that weekend.
So this is the horrible thing. And this is the point, the tipping point came about a year later when I asked my dad to drive me to Basildon from Bristol to meet him at a DVD signing. They've reissued some of the old Doctor Who's on DVD. And he was there. No, it wasn't DVD. It was Big Finish. The living Doctor Who actors would sort of revisit them and do like new stories for audio. And he was like signing a CD of that. And I went along with my dad to Basildon, and he didn't remember me. I was mortified. It was only a year later, and like I was so crestfallen, and he couldn't. And he called, oh God, I think he must have been in a bad mood, but he told me, because I took loads of stuff for him to sign again, thinking nothing of it, because I'm being kind of nosy, that's fine. And he called me greedy for taking so much stuff for him to sign. And I just remember that as like, that was the beginning of the end.
What, that's like ending your signing career?
Yeah, that was it petering out, because I sort of realised I can't be friends with these people. I have nothing to offer these people as a friend. I'm just a weird, fucking awful nerd. It was so bad. So much shame.
I don't think you should feel as much shame.
Why?
Well, especially like the time you gave him the bust.
Don't call it a bust. Because a bust, it was a death mask. A bust implies something resembling artistic flair. This was a death mask. This was bad.
I mean, does it look like his face?
It's like a perfectly flat clay, like baked as well. Like, bear in mind, possibly worse than giving it to Colin Baker himself is the fact that I made this in school for a graded project, and my teacher had to put that in like a kiln to like make it into a proper piece of clay that I could then paint, as if that wasn't completely mental.
So was the very final signature that you ever got Colin Baker's?
No. I broke my sort of autograph chastity when I met the Strokes. Which is way cooler than anyone else I've met before or since. I met the Strokes outside the Colston Hall, and I was about 18, and I was really into music, and it didn't feel lame, it felt fine. Because like, everyone else there was quite cool and indie-ish, and not just a bunch of fucking weird people wearing tracksuits, like shiny tracksuits. Everyone who collects autographs looks like Jimmy Savile used to. Like everyone, everyone. That's the uniform. Yeah, that was the last one I got, because I think when I started doing comedy, I would never dream of doing that. Even though I've like gigged with some of my absolute heroes, I've been really lucky to do that. I couldn't. Like, it's too, like, you're too much, like, you're not, like, obviously you're not on their level, but like you're too much a contemporary now that compromises that. Sometimes I get really tempted. Like, I did a gig with Harry Redknapp, which wasn't a gig. Like, he was doing like an after dinner chat thing. And I was comparing it. And that's the closest I've come to trying to get anything. And I still bottled it because I felt too much shame. So ashamed. But yeah, have you ever got any autographs, Daryl?
I think I may have got something signed somewhere along the line. But I genuinely... Yeah. I tell you what, this is the only signature that I have ever got. It was Izzy Wizzy at Butlin's.
No way. Who the fuck is that?
At Butlin's, there was this group of, like, you know, the Red Coats?
Yes, I know the Red Coats.
There
was,
like, the Super Red Coats, which were the Whiz Kids.
I've literally never heard of that. That sounds like a cult.
They were just, like, some children's entertainers.
Were they communists? Is that what they were?
Yeah, yeah. And they were teaching us, like, how to plough the land and stuff like that.
No, plough the land?
No, they this weren't really. They weren't, no.
That was a good joke, mate.
Thank you. Izzy Wizzy, who was just one of the people going there. I was, like, 10 years old. She was going back to her chalet.
Yeah.
And my mum went, that's Izzy Wizzy. And so...
hounded her to her chalet.
Yeah, so she just signed like a bit of paper that we had, and that is the only signature I've ever got.
Do they have a kiln at Butlin's? You're gonna make a little death mask for her for, yeah, the end of your trip.
No,
she'd love that.
Never felt compelled. The only question that I've got left for you is, you mentioned a couple of times your friend who you used to go and get signatures.
Andy, yeah.
Yeah, do you still speak?
No, we're not. We don't see each other anymore. Not because we've fallen out. Like, he still lives in Bristol. I live in London now. Last time I saw him was about 3 years ago. He just happened to see me waiting at a bus stop. But I think he's an auctioneer now. Like, because he's actually gone properly into that.
Oh, wow.
Side of it. Like, yeah, he's actually like makes money out of it and is like a businessman and is doing really well. Whereas I basically live hand to mouth by calling everyone cunts all the time. but it's close to the dream, isn't it? But yeah, I'd like to see him again. I haven't seen him in fucking ages, but he was always very switched on. And I think he, much like most people, just indulged me. Because I got him onto it. I got him onto doing it, like onto doing autographs and stuff. Yeah. Like, it was my thing that he sort of just latched onto. But now it's like his livelihood. Yeah, he's like an auctioneer. Yeah.
I've never thought of getting signatures as being any use to creating a career.
Yeah, it's ridiculous, isn't it? It's ridiculous that someone else doing you a favour for free can make you a lot of money.
It's a
weird business model, isn't it? Like, the idea that, like, you go to a stage door and you get, like, fucking some, like, actor to sign a programme and you can sell that. They've not given you permission to sell it. They've just signed it out of thinking, like, oh, maybe they just want this.
Yeah.
But you make money from it. That feels like a massive con, doesn't it? But I guess you put the legwork in, don't you, I suppose?
Yeah, but it's in, like, I suppose in signing, you're giving permission for it. There must be some sort of laws around it that it's absolutely fine.
I also think there's a moral question, isn't there? Because I remember there was this guy, he wasn't like a mate of mine and Andy's, he was just a guy that we saw like around because he would always be at the same sort of places and the same sort of people were gigging at wherever. And he was like boasting about the fact that he had basically ambushed Sid Barrett. Do you know Sid Barrett?
No.
So Sid Barrett was in Pink Floyd. He was the founder of Pink Floyd, and had a really severe, like, life changing nervous breakdown. I think in like 1969 or something like that. Like, shaved all his body hair off, put loads of weight on, and then like just walked out of their recording studio and just walked all the way home to Cambridge. Like, basically, lived a life as like a really sort of like weird like recluse. I think he moved in with his mum or something. And like, he changed back to his original birth name, which I can't remember what it was, but like, his stage name was Sid Barrett, it was called something else. And this guy found out where he lived in Cambridge and like went to his door, pretended to be a postman, and got him to sign for something. That got his autograph that way. That's fucking mental, isn't it? That's like another level of like, that's sinister.
Yeah, the fun element is totally removed at that point.
Yeah.
Because I suppose if you're going to like at a convention or you're at a gig or something, I feel like they've got control.
Yeah.
They can choose if they want to sign your stuff, whereas you're tricking someone into signing something.
Someone who has made an executive decision not to be in the limelight anymore. He's in one of the biggest bands of all time, and he chooses to live a life of complete anonymity to the point he's changed his name. But to hunt that guy down, I think that's really like not on and quite sinister. That's where the kind of morality goes out the window a bit. There are some weird fucking people out there. Like, I mean, I say that, I made a death mask for Colin Baker, so, you know, I can't judge him. Why am I judging him? What a creep. Fuck, I'm so full of shit. But yeah, God, I have so much shame for that.
Well, George, thank you so much for sharing that shame.
I mean, I would say thank you for having me, but I regret all of this.
That is pretty much the general reply at the end of the show. Yeah, I hated doing that.
I mean, it was not. It's always nice to spend time with you, Daryl. You're a lovely lad, and we have a lot of fun together. But you may not see me again. I might just go and kill myself. Bloody hell.
Right, well, if you don't do that, how can people follow you or see your gigs?
Oh, okay. I don't fucking know. Like, I'm not really good at that sort of stuff.
Are you on Twitter?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter. Just G Rigdon Comedian. Find me on there. If you're in Bristol, I run two gigs here still that are really nice. Oppo last Sunday of the month at the Robin Hood, and the Bunch of Chase at Smoke and Mirrors every Monday. But again, this will probably be like such a good podcast that goes into like a time capsule. So this plug will be irrelevant in about 5 years' time. So it basically just keep an ear to the ground, because I am pretty much smashing it everywhere, and I'm probably the voice of a generation now.
All right, it's been a pleasure having you, George.
Thanks for having me, mate. It's been fun.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. This has been I'd Sooner Forget This. If you could do us a favor, make sure that you click subscribe, give the podcast a review. It costs you nothing, but it is like well worth it for me. Yeah, make sure that you listen to next week's show. I've been Daryl Smith. Bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.